Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with novelist Jamie Attenberg, whose new book is All This Could Be Yours. And I'll have a preview of the Louisiana Book Festival coming up November 2nd. It's a great pleasure to welcome Jamie Attenberg back to The Reading Life. Jamie's the author of Instant Love, The Kept Man, The Melting Season, The Middlesteins, and the New York Times bestseller St. Maisie and All Grown Up. Today, we're celebrating her seventh book, All This Can Be Yours, the first of her novels to be set in her adopted hometown of New Orleans. Jamie, so good to see you.
Hi, Susan. I'm so happy to be here.
Now, you're coming to us with this book, with a new title from the Kirkus reviewer of your book, The Poet Laureate of Family Dysfunction. Now, that's something really special.
I've never had a title like that before. I feel really like it's probably going to go in my grave. I'm pretty excited about it.
I know. And it's true. It works. So tell us about this story. It's a story of a family in crisis, and everyone's waiting for the patriarch to die, which is a fairly dramatic situation.
I started off with thinking about a family member waiting for another family member to die, but not being too sorry about it. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of animosity towards this main character, Victor Tuckman, and we meet his wife and we meet his daughter and his daughter-in-law and his son, and they all have different feelings about him, and not a lot of them are positive.
So
I was kind of intrigued by that idea where you're sort of wrestling with grief and wrestling with emotions, but having it be kind of more complicated.
And this is a situation everybody will face eventually. We're all going to be in that situation where someone will be dying and we won't be sorry.
Right.
I mean, maybe not for the same reasons the Tuckmans are, which are valid, it seems to me.
Right. But I think that it's like very healthy that all these characters are going through what they're going through, and they're kind of facing their demons with him and their demons within themselves. Also, they sort of are very wry about it. It was kind of fun to write a funny family, too. Mm-hmm.
So talk about what this means to you personally, this whole idea of coming of loss, reckoning with the idea of forgiveness, whether or not to give it. It's something we're all thinking about.
I know. I love my parents and I would like them to live forever. I would like everyone in my life to live forever, hopefully. But I do think about mortality and mortality issues now that I'm in my 40s. And I think about that a lot and being proud of how I live my life. And so I think that I have found my way through writing about this, about these people questioning their past and their family members' past. I find my way through thinking about what I'm doing with my life. And hopefully the book is sort of open enough that anyone can kind of insert themselves into it in different places.
Well, there's this moment where his daughter thinks, this is happening. This is the real deal. Mm. You know, I'm going to have to deal with this. And I think a moment like this is a prism through which you reflect character, history, all kinds of things.
Yeah, it's a great device, right? Mm-hmm. It's a great device for a fiction writer to, death is a wonderful device, you know, for us to get to know these characters. Alex Tuckman, who's the daughter, who has perhaps the most complicated relationship of all with him, she doesn't believe that it will put her at peace to forgive him. And yet she goes through this process, this really intense process of forgiving him, of actually standing at his bedside and talking to him and trying to work things out. And I think that in the moment, we don't always get the resolution that we want. And maybe it takes 5 years or 10 years down the road. But then there's sort of this little peace time bomb that can go off later. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I think we're just witnessing, the whole book just takes place over the course of one day.
I know.
So we're just
brilliant.
Yeah. there's lots of flashbacks. So you see like a bigger life story for all these people, but it's set morning, noon, and evening for the most part. I just wanted to show what happens exactly in that moment, that sort of really precise. There's like a moment where Alex says something like, you don't really know how you're going to feel when your father's dying.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know how you're going to react until it actually happens, until you're actually in that moment. And so I don't think anyone knows the right way to be. I don't think anyone knows how to react. We surprise ourselves with the ways that we react to death and to grief.
And one of the characters reacts by not wanting to be there.
Yeah, that would be, I think I'm Gary.
You're Gary.
I would be the son, Gary. He's out in Los Angeles. He works in the film and television industry. He lives in New Orleans, but he's out in LA trying to get some work going. And he doesn't want to go home. And he sort of just keeps missing flights. He's just sort of smoking weed and hanging out in Airbnb and missing his flights. And I don't smoke weed, but I would probably be sitting in an Airbnb missing flights. I'm of the avoidance
school.
I'm of the avoidance school. But, you know, writing this book is like a way, I think, for me to recognize that the avoidance school is not really the way to go about it, because you always have to deal with it. One way or another, you always are going to have to deal with it.
Sooner or later.
Yep. I mean, it's coming for you.
So what was it like for you to bring this family from all over the place, mostly Connecticut, to New Orleans and unfold this story here? They're immigrants.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So for me, because I moved here full time 4 years ago, for me, it was kind of the safe way for me to start writing about New Orleans, to have these characters who are from outside of the city come in and witness the city from a fresh outsider perspective. Now, more characters from New Orleans sort of pop up in the book along the way. But for me, this was the way that I could give myself permission to write about New Orleans, I think, initially, because I was really scared to write about the city. Very protective of the city, as everyone is that lives here. You know, no matter how long you've lived here, you begin to feel very protective of this place. And so I just wanted to be able to do it justice, and I wanted to feel comfortable. And I sat on it really for a couple of years. I mean, the first 2 years that I lived here, I didn't start writing about New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was too scared to do it. And I was waiting. I really was waiting for somebody to give me permission. And then one day I woke up and realized no one was going to give me permission. I had to give permission to myself. And so that's, I think, how I got to the place of writing about these outsiders. I thought, well, start with what you know.
Yeah.
And that's what I knew coming in and being new in town.
Well, you said that you were worried about moving here, about making the place you went to get away your home. Mm. And you were worried how that would work out.
It's worked out fine. I like it here.
I had a feeling.
It's worked out really. I mean, I had lived in New York for a really long time, for most of my adult life, actually, like 18 years, something like that. And I've traveled and lived all over the world in various places for months at a time, and sort of checking out where I would want to move to. And New Orleans was the place that captivated me the most. Everyone feels this way, that when you come here, you're coming home.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always happy to come home here. And I've been able to meet a lot of people in the writing community and make friends in my neighborhood. And so it's just been really wonderful for me to move here, even as this is a really complicated city in so many ways. Like, I don't view it with starry eyes at all. Like,
right.
I mean, that was an interesting thing, writing about this place and not wanting to write a starry-eyed version of it, but mm-hmm. also having it be a love letter to the city in a lot of ways. And I think one of the ways that I got around it being kind of this cliched version is that I had one character in particular who doesn't really like it here.
Uh-huh.
And so she, Barbara, who is Victor Tuckman's wife, she moved down here kind of unwillingly with Victor. Victor had, you know, they're sort of leaving this little scandal behind in their past, and they moved down here to get away from it because they had children down here who had moved down here. And Barbara moves down here and she sort of has to be convinced. And every time she does something that's sort of typically New Orleanian, she's kind of doesn't get it at all. Like, she goes to a crawfish boil and she's really grossed out. And she goes to, you know, Audubon Park and she's just like, birds, trees, dirt. She's wearing the wrong shoes always. So it was kind of fun to write about New Orleans that way, from that perspective. And so I could still write about it lovingly, but also kind of teasingly at the same time.
And truly. Yeah. It's hot. It's hot in this book.
It's set on one hot day in August. And so I really worked so hard. I mean, I was writing it last summer. It was my third summer here. So it wasn't unfamiliar to me, but it was very, very hot last summer. It's hot every summer.
It's hot now.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you about something else. You posted on Facebook. You are a wonderful Facebooker, as you know.
High praise. Thank you.
And you wrote something recently where you said, for a long time, I wondered if I were going to be able to have this life, to do this. And now I realize I can.
Yeah.
And it makes me really happy. How much of that has to do with being here, being where you are in your career. Talk a little bit about that.
I mean, it's interesting because I'm 47. I'll be 48 in a month from today, actually. We're all kind of making it up as we go along. But but to have the dream of being a writer and just working every day at that and only that is, I mean, it was really like a big fantasy of mine. I didn't know what it looked like, but now I know, you know, that I've arrived at it. But also that I was able to be happy and calmer. That has to do with me moving down here, I think. But it is kind of a chicken and egg kind of thing. It's like you have to be ready to approach that place in your life.
Yeah.
Because I could have just stayed in New York, or I could have moved somewhere. I mean, there's just a million things that I could have done. But like coming down here was, there was a specific choice. There were specific decisions that I was making by coming and moving to this next place in my life. I think I had already gotten there and I just needed to fully arrive.
Right. Welcome.
Thanks.
What else can you say? If you're just joining us, I'm talking with novelist Jamie Attenberg, author of All This Could Be Yours. Well, one of the things I want to talk about are the minor characters in this book, because I love them so much. You paint such a vivid portrait of New Orleans through the minor characters, and these are the sorts of people that make all New Orleanians' lives interesting, funnier, better. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you have the paramedic who tends to Victor. You have the coroner. You have a waitress. You have a cashier at the CVS. I love the streetcar driver who says, yeah, I'll stop for that lady. She looks like she needs a ride.
Yep.
You know, we all hope for that someday. So it was really interesting to see you build the city from those points of view.
Yeah, I mean, they were, like I said, I started off with the Tuckmans, although I always knew there was a character, Sharon, who is the medical examiner who shows up later in the book. She was always there from the beginning. They all just show up and they kind of demand attention. Initially, it was just going to be from female perspectives. I was going to do Victor's wife and daughter and daughter-in-law and this woman, Sharon. And as I wrote, all of New Orleans seemed to be yelling at me and saying, you really think you're going to do that? And just insisting to be in all of these different scenes. You know, writing is joyful for me. It's playful. It's really organic. It's really natural, especially when you're writing that first draft. So you just have to let everybody in that wants to come in and let them say what they have to say. And then you can edit it later on if it's not working. But if you want to get anywhere creatively, really, you just sort of have to let things flow in that way. And I heard so many characters chattering at me, and they become a device to a writing device, because you can take a step back from the scene, from being so insistently in one character's head, and let another character sort of tell the story for a moment and reflect on the person that they see before them. So there were a lot of things going on, but really, truly, it was about me living here and observing and listening to what was going around me, on around me in the world.
Well, one of the things you do so brilliantly in this character of Sharon, who is my favorite character too, I just loved her.
Oh, thank you.
Is the way she carries on so resolutely, and you capture a real New Orleans voice in her.
Oh,
so I wonder if you would read that passage for us.
I'm happy to. I worked the hardest on Sharon, for sure. I had lots of readers on her, and I loved her and felt really protective of her. And okay. The moon was self-important and disapproving above the disheveled state of the backyard. Some weeds were as high as her waist. She began to wrestle with them, and the thrashing sound seemed loud, and she worried for a moment that someone could hear her. But who would be listening? Who cared what happened in this backyard but her? She carried on with feverish intent. As she trimmed, she heard her mother talking to her, telling her about the importance of weeding every week. You can't do it once and then sit back all proud of yourself. No, every week things need to be maintained. Get your hands dirty, Sharon. Nothing's going to change unless you get your hands in that dirt. She pulled huge handfuls. She chopped. She plucked. For a minute, she violently sneezed. All around her, the bugs started to gather. She had prepared herself with bug spray, but still she could feel the occasional rush of them against her skin, and she swatted them off. Sharon knew she was doing this for herself, but also this was part of something bigger, this maintenance of the land. One house goes down, who's to say the next one won't go down too? This seemed predictable to her, that she'd have to use her body to fix something a man had done, especially a white man, if she was being honest here, to keep this city going. She had family members who labored all over New Orleans, were custodians of the city in one way or another, just as she was. An uncle who drove a streetcar, keeping the city moving, even if it was slowly. A cousin who had bartended for decades in the quarter for the approval of tourists. Cousins who were home caregivers or who had built houses from the ground up, or who had cooked and cleaned or smiled in one of the many hotels, bars, and restaurants in the city. She had another one who had been working on the ferry for decades, taking dollar bills from strangers, getting people across the river, and sometimes she'd go give him a quick hello, ask after his children, of which he had seven. Hop a ride to the West Bank and back, watch him do his job just to be proud of him. She had cousins all over the place, or rather, everyone felt like her cousin, and a lot of them were working hard. We power this city, she thought. We are the bodies. We are the labor. She kept chopping. She glanced up at the fig tree. She'd be taking whatever was left on the tree with her that night. Then she flashed on her father leaning on the old chain link fence, a cold beer in his hand, and Mr. Lewis barbecuing next door, popping some figs in his mouth, and she ached for times like that. She had loved her parents. Those days are gone, she thought. Alone in this world, a little bit lonely, she supposed. Who among us is not alone? She thought every day at work as she tended to those before her. This weekend, her family in New Orleans East was throwing a barbecue for Labor Day, and they had insisted she come because she suspected they had a man they wanted her to meet. Some people didn't like it when you were alone and fun with it. Yes, she was lonely sometimes, but she knew more than enough people who were partnered up with children who felt the same. Lonely was something you were born with, she felt. Lonely was about not feeling understood or heard. You could be in a room full of people and still feel that way. That was why she liked church, because it was the time she set aside to think about God. She didn't always feel like contemplating God. It was challenging to focus her mind on that specific image, that kind of light in her head. Even if she could, if her mind was open and available, she felt resentful toward God for things that were happening in the world and had no desire to spend time with him or her or whatever it was. But Sundays she was ready, and when she thought about God in the purest moments, she was never alone.
I love that. This is a very spiritual book. You're thinking about a lot of these things right now.
Oh my gosh, Susan, I worked really hard on this book.
Well, it shows.
It's definitely like it's a middle-aged novel for me, like a mid-career mm-hmm. novel. Like I've been writing and working and thinking for 16 years, however long I've been doing this. So I just really wanted to do this story justice, these characters justice, the city justice. It was just a very pure intention on my part.
Did it feel different to you as you were doing it?
I felt like I was using all my skills.
Ah, that's a great feeling.
Yeah. I was trying all these different things out. You know, I also, my last book, which I loved also, was first person. There's a lot you get out of writing a first person novel. Like, you know, you get this sense of authenticity that you can't really get in a third person or a close third person. And so there was a lot that I loved about writing that. But when you switch over to a chorus of voices, as this book is, you get to try out lots of different kinds of things. I appreciated the constraints of the last book, and that was a really good exercise for me. But whatever I lost in having many voices, I gained in, I mean, I think of them as tricks, which sounds like a joke or something like that. And they're not jokes, but for me, they're just, you know, tricks of the trade, I guess.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with novelist Jamie Attenberg, author of All This Could Be Yours. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm talking with novelist Jamie Attenberg. It's a great skill to create characters who are so flawed and make us care so deeply about them.
Thanks. I always start off with either liking a character and then trying to figure out what I don't like about them or what mm-hmm. their flaws are, or not liking them and then trying to figure out what I could like about them, or at least why they are the way that they are. And I had started off way more with people I didn't like in this book and tried to write my way into liking them. I think also that might be why this chorus of voices from New Orleans kept popping up, because I was like, I need to take a break from these people. Even
Save
though they're
me.
they're good to spend time with. Like, again, I think I created this sort of flexible enough structure around them that you as the reader can sort of put yourself in, dive into little moments and see yourself in them. I've had enough readers of this book surprise me and just say, I'm really exactly like Barbara, or I'm really exactly like Twyla. Somebody the other day said, I'm really like Victor. And I was like, you are not like
what?
Victor. And it was, yeah, and it was a woman yeah. too. I think she sort of got his maybe aggressiveness or something like that. I don't know. Or sort of need for success. It's really surprising to me how people connect with these characters.
Now, this is a book that has been welcomed into the world with open arms. This is on every must-read list for the fall. I can't open a magazine without seeing Jamie Attenberg. All this could be yours. Beautiful orange cover.
I paid them all off. No, there's not enough money to pay all those people off.
No, of course not. So how does that make going out on tour different for you? Because you're a really good soldier when it comes to doing that. You really do the work.
I mean, I do. I've been doing this for so long that, first of all, going out on tour is like basically just seeing a bunch of people from my past, which is really which is really nice. Readers,
yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I've had quiet launches and I've had noisy launches, and I much prefer it to be noisy. But I will say that there is no guarantee of book sales. It probably is helpful in terms of if I want to publish the next book, but this kind of press is, it helps to get the word out, but I think the thing that keeps books selling is word of mouth from readers.
Yeah.
Because I've had books that have been marketed totally incorrectly because they just think it's written by a woman, so it's just we're gonna fit this into this neat little, mm-hmm. Women's fiction box. And readers don't really like to be lied to, and a bait and switch is unwelcome, I think, in the reading community. So for me, it's like wonderful that I'm going out with enthusiasm and that my publisher is sending me on this really big tour. But the proof will be when people read it and talk about it or don't talk about it. But I'm hoping that the readers are going to be excited about it.
They are. They're going to love it. I feel sure. We've been talking with Jamie Attenberg, whose wonderful new book, All This Could Be Yours, will break your heart. You can meet her when she discusses and signs that book Tuesday, November 5th at 6 at the Hotel Peter and Paul, where she'll be appearing with Margaret Wilkerson Sexton, author of The Revisioners. Jamie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Fall and festivals are in the air. First up, get ready for the New Orleans Book Festival, coming up November 2nd at the State Capitol Complex in Baton Rouge. Things get off to a great start at 9 a.m. Saturday when New Orleans author Richard Campanella receives the Louisiana Writer Award, and State Poet Laureate John Warner Smith presents a reading that morning as well. There will be more than 230 authors on hand, including Jamie Attenberg, author of All This Could Be Yours, Daniel Brook, author of The Accident of Color, A Story of Race and Reconstruction, Sarah Broom, author of The Yellow House, Casey Sepp, author of Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and The Last Trial of Harper Lee, Steve Luxenberg, author of Separate, Plessy v. Ferguson, and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation, Josh Levin, author of The Queen, The Forgotten Life Behind an American Myth, John McCusker appears with Shane Leaf. Their book is Giacomo, The Native Roots of Mardi Gras Indians. Nathaniel Rich talks about Losing Earth, A Recent History. Maurice Carlos Ruffin talks about We Cast a Shadow. Margaret Wilkerson Sexton talks about her new book, The Revisioners, and Albert Woodfox, author of the National Book Award nominee, Solitary, My Story of Transformation and Hope. There's a massive book tent, exhibition tents with publishers and small presses, book artists and book organizations, a young readers tent featuring music and storytelling, and other activities in front of the State Library. There's a teen hangout inside the State Library. And like every Louisiana festival, there will be food and music and lots of it. The festival is free and the complete schedule is at louisianabookfestival.org. But if you'd like to take one of the festival's special workshops, writing classes with featured writers on Friday, here's the schedule. From 9 a.m. to noon, Michael Knight teaches Fiction Beyond Description, Mining Imagery for Meaning. And Michelle Philgate teaches Nonfiction, Unlocking the Box, Writing Personal Essays. From 1 to 4, Steph Post teaches Fiction, Mythmaking and Breaking, How to Use Old Stories to Write Something New. And Steve Luxenberg teaches Nonfiction, Finding Your Narrative, at the Crossroads of Memory, Journalism, and History. For fee information or to register, call 225-219-9503 or visit louisianabookfestival.org/workshops. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Todd Elliott discusses and signs his novel The Lower Line, Sunday, October 27th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. Jackie Gingrich Cushman appears in conversation with James Farwell discussing her book, Our Broken America, Why Both Sides Need to Stop Ranting and Start Listening, followed by a book signing Monday, October 28th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Octavia Books presents Chef Justin DeVillier discussing and signing his new cookbook, The New Orleans Kitchen, Classic Recipes and Modern Techniques for an Unrivaled Cuisine, Tuesday, October 29th at 6 at the New Orleans Culinary and Hospitality Institute, 725 Howard Avenue. Tickets available at Octavia Books. Claire Fullerton discusses and signs Morning Dove at the meeting of the New Orleans chapter of the Pulpwood Queens Book Club, Tuesday, October 29th at 5 at Garden District Bookshop. Thomas Bonner Jr., Professor Emeritus of English at Xavier University, discusses Poe, Hawthorne, and the Gothic tradition, Tuesday, October 29th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Octavia Books presents Ta-Nehisi Coates reading and discussing his first novel, Water Dancer, in conversation with novelist Jessamyn Ward, Wednesday, October 30th at 6 at Temple Sinai, 6227 St. Charles Avenue. Tickets available at Octavia Books. Celeste Norris discusses and signs Cajun by Blood, a Thibodeau family story, Wednesday, October 30th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Poppy Tooker, whose most recent book is Drag Queen Brunch, discusses the haunted restaurants of New Orleans, Wednesday, October 30th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Paula Mounier discusses and signs Blind Search, a Mercy Car Mystery, Sunday, November 3rd at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. And soon after that, it's time for Improv NOLA Festival of Ideas, which takes place November 3rd, then picks up again November 8th through 10th. Jules Pfeiffer and Michael Pollan are the headliners, and there are many other writers to meet as well. Check out improvconferencenola.com for tickets and a complete schedule. Don't forget to listen in next Tuesday at 7:44 a.m. during Morning Edition and 5:44 p.m. during All Things Considered for our new series, Thinking Outside the Book. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org.